This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former Interior Secretary, Governor of Arizona, and one-time presidential candidate Bruce Babbitt doesn't much fit the mold of environmental zealot. In the Clinton years, while developers screamed at his conservation push, the Green Lobby complained that he sold out the West. But Bruce Babbitt has been a solid voice for leaving future generations an American environment of health and biological diversity and open space. And right now, he's worried about that legacy, about the urban sprawl that continues to chew up the countryside, and land use policy from the Mississippi Delta to the Midwest Farm Belt that is tearing up America. Up next on Point, Bruce Babbitt on the future of the American environment. Joining me now from Washington is Bruce Babbitt, Secretary of the Interior from 1993 to 2001 under Bill Clinton. He was governor of Arizona from 1978 to 1987 and a Democratic presidential candidate in 1988. He is currently a member of the board of directors of the World Wildlife Fund. His new book is Cities in the Wilderness, A New Vision of Land Use in America. Bruce Babbitt, welcome to On Point.
Tom, Happy New Year. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy New Year to you. It's great to have you. Mr. Babbitt, I wonder how you see, you've got a long political history as well as a long environmental history. How do you read the way Americans understand the health of their environment? I mean, I sometimes feel that people think, well, we came through the kind of big years of the environmental movement. There are more forests in many parts of the countries now. We're told that we've cleaned up lots of waters and lots of air. I think people feel like we're not doing too badly. Do you think Americans have an accurate understanding of the state and direction of their environment?
Well, Tom, there's kind of a paradox here. There's no question that our neighborhoods feel better. We've cleaned up a lot of the untreated sewage. The neighborhood rivers are no longer, catching fire. We've certainly cleared up air quality over the major urban areas. So if you're thinking about pollution in the relation of air quality, water quality, hazardous waste to our health in the short run, we've made a lot of progress. But in the terms of the larger scale of the large landscapes, ecosystems, the condition of our and productivity of our oceans, forests, the open space, we're still losing. If you look across the street, it looks better. But if you look across an entire valley or an ecosystem, you can see the degradation is still very much in evidence.
Now, why is that? Is that because there has not been further improvement since the 90s when you were in power? Is it because there have been steps backward in the years since then?
Well, I think it's because on all sides of these issues, we have not come to grips with the need for land use planning and looking at large landscapes and saying, it is not enough just to say to the neighborhood industry, quit polluting the water. The death of Chesapeake Bay, just to take one example, or the Great Lakes, is a lot more subtle than just industrial pollution. It comes from the way we use the land and the kind of sprawl that creates stormwater, a polluted runoff, the inappropriate use of agriculture, down in river bottoms where it really doesn't belong, the mismanagement of forests. I think what I'm advocating in this book is, frankly, rather than celebrating our successes, which, of course, I'm prepared to do but will pass on, and rather than, detailing all of the misdeeds of this administration, which are ample and many, none of us have come to grips with the need to deal with sprawl and unsustainable development and do that in the context of having land use plans which say we're going to have more compact cities, we're going to have urban boundaries around them, we are going to protect not just a neighborhood park, not just a couple hundred acres, but we're going to think about protecting entire landscapes, whether it's in the Shenandoah Valley, whether it is the Catskills and the other mountains of New England. And we've never done that in the history of this country. We've never put up a map of, say, the state that a listener is living in and saying, what do we want this to look like 50 years or 100 years from now? What are the limits? What's the balance? And until we answer that question, we're going to continue to have this kind of slow degradation that's manifest in endangered species, the decline of fisheries, and a sort of slow sort of attenuation and elimination of many parts of the natural world.
You say Americans themselves have not really absorbed this. You were a great advocate of the view that we could have both conservation, a healthy environment, and a strong economy. Do I hear you backing off of that to some degree here?
Not at all. Absolutely not. It's, you know, this is a huge land we live on. There is plenty of room to find resources and to develop. And it's going to be a big challenge. We're a nation of 300 million now. There are going to be another 150 million people in this country sometime between 2040 and 2050. There's still enough room, but we can't continue just to spread, you know, sort of endlessly in kind of amoeba-like fashion across the land. We're going to have to plan the way we develop and do it in a more restrained, thoughtful way. It's not one versus the other. But we surely have to end this, sort of random, unplanned approach to resource utilization.
We're eager to hear exactly where you would put that land use expertise, but take us on a little tour here. When you describe that going from 300 million to 450 million, half a billion nearly Americans, just 30, 40, 50 years from now, take us on a tour. If we don't change our land use patterns, what are the likely consequences going to be? What's the country going to look like? And what changes might we see in 2050 that we'd be surprised by today?
Well, it's obviously hard to predict, but the patterns, I think, are emerging quite clearly. Most of the population is now concentrating in sort of the center is emptying out toward the coastal areas. And I think what that means is unless we change, we will see a solid urban corridor that runs all the way down the East Coast from Boston to New York, Philadelphia, Washington, through the Shenandoah Valley and the Piedmont, I think all the way down to Atlanta. It will be, we will essentially fill in all the gaps, and there will be, a megacity there. Florida will become sort of an urbanized state. We will see it across much of the Gulf Coast, although New Orleans surely puts up a red flag there. California, the Pacific Northwest, and the Great Lakes states. These places will surely have the benefits of the dynamism from increased population, but the threat of degradation and destruction of the water resources and the natural world is really extreme, I think.
Dave is calling from Brookfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for bringing this timely subject to listeners so early in the new year.
Good to have you. What do you think?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. My family and I just returned from Christmas vacation in the New Mexico and the Colorado Rockies, and saw enormous urban sprawl in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. I haven't been back there in 13 or 14 years, and I was stunned with the expansion. And a couple of days after Christmas, I had the opportunity to drive to the top of Pikes Peak with my son.
Yeah.
I used to live in the region. And I was stunned again with the lack of snow up there. It's a 14,100-foot mountain. There was a foot of snow up there. There should be, at this time of year, 8 to 10 feet of snowpack. And my question to Mr. Babbitt is, what are his thoughts on climate change?
That's as big a question as you can raise. Dave, thanks for doing it. Bruce Babbitt.
Dave, it is surely the most urgent environmental problem of the 21st century because it affects all ecological systems, everybody, everywhere. We're going to see the consequences of this in many ways, the melting of glaciers, the rising sea levels implicated again in the destruction of New Orleans. It's about fossil fuels. It's about controlling carbon dioxide emissions. It's about some national leadership in doing two things, to get at the major sources of carbon dioxide pollution, which is causing the greenhouse effect. The first one is to regulate power plants, which are the single largest source. There's a system called cap and trade, which is well understood. It's been used for sulfur and other pollutants.
This is trading pollutant emissions.
Yeah, exactly. You put a cap on, and everybody's got to reach it. You reach it in the most economical way by letting people who can reduce to meet the standard easily sell the credits that they accumulate to those who can't.
Is that happening properly now?
It's not happening at all because this administration just, you know, blindly, pigheadedly, on ideological grounds, says we're against regulation, and the consequences be damned. That's the first step. There is a bill in the Senate sponsored by John McCain and Joe Lieberman, very sensible, lays out the pathway to this. The second one is automobiles, of course, and step one in automobiles is auto mileage standards. We had them back in the 70s. They made a big difference. We've largely abandoned those mileage standards. Ironically, at the very time that we have the hybrid technology, which would allow us to reduce carbon emissions by setting a mileage, an average mileage standard of, say, 40 miles per gallon, which could easily be met. Some of the states are starting in this direction to their great credit now. But it really does take a national program and national leadership.
Our caller was, he says, stunned to go out to the Southwest, your part of the country, and see the urban sprawl even there. Do Americans have an accurate picture in mind of what this country really looks like today in 2006 when you get out and drive through it?
Well, it's a problem of the shifting baseline, as the scientists call it. We don't tend to notice the small incremental changes that take place in our own neighborhoods. What Dave was illustrating is you see it only when you step outside of your daily, steadily accumulating kind of changing environment and look at something you haven't seen for 10 or 15 years. So the Sun Belt is going to be one of these mega areas that I talked about as the country sort of empties out, no longer tied to the old river ports and industrial sites. People live where they want to live. The Sun Belt is either the beneficiary or the victim of it, depending on how you see this. But until we can set up a system in which we've got a national attention to this land use planning issue, it's just going to continue.
And global warming, Dave raises, what consequences do you see in this century? They will be global, but in this country?
Well, let me give you, I think, the most striking example, and it is Louisiana, not just New Orleans, but the Mississippi River Delta and the Gulf Coast of Louisiana. There's a scientific consensus now that as a result of global warming, expanding seawater, which expands as it warms, and rising sea levels will worldwide in the 21st century rise between 2 and 4 feet. Now, my question is this. Does anyone know how many of the residents, not just of New Orleans, but of Louisiana, live less than 3 feet below, above sea level?
And I've read you saying nearly half.
Yeah, it's about 2.5 million people in Louisiana who are living in the Delta region who are going to be underwater by the end of this century. It's going to happen in many other places around the world, and our leaders are not even talking about it, much less acknowledging it and then trying to do something about it.
So, but what do you do? First of all, is to deal with the warming as best we can, and you've pointed to several things there, but what about for those 2.5 million people? For New Orleans, you've already written, you've said, make it an island. Forget about trying to have it attached by too much land because it's not going to happen to the rest of the lower 48. But what do you do with 2.5 million people in Louisiana?
Well, the first thing that the federal government could do is stop subsidizing and paying people to go back and rebuild their homes in the path of these rising sea levels. Our national leaders are complicit in the decisions that are going to lead to the next tragedy. We should have, of course, specifically in the case of New Orleans, some leadership which says, let's put together a land use plan. Let's give Louisiana the right incentives to put together a land use plan and start specifying where you can reasonably expect to live without being wiped out, and those places you can't. Instead, FEMA, the much maligned FEMA.
Maligned?
By all sides. Is doing this. It's really, it's quite unbelievable. They have put out the maps. They acknowledge that there are vast areas where flooding will occur from sea level rising and increased power of hurricanes. And then they turn around and hand out grants and subsidies for people to go back and resettle the very areas that their maps show are going to be underwater. New Orleans is in the process of losing half its population. And that means that it's a shrinking city and that the planning should take place for a city half the size. I mean, it's less than half of its size right now. There'll be some coming back, but it's clear that it'll be about 250,000 people. Now, the New Orleans City Council is saying we're going to let people come back and settle, resettle wherever they want.
Mm-hmm.
That'll create a disaster of a city with abandoned buildings, vast tracts of empty space between houses. It's the kind of thing you can see in, of all places, Detroit right now, a city which has lost population.
Hardly the model you want to follow.
Which has failed to deal with the shrinking city syndrome and has what they call kind of jack-o'-lantern neighborhoods. You know, there's all these huge gaps, and it is a disaster.
So how do you shrink the city without turning it into a yuppie Disney World?
Well, you shrink the city with a plan which says we are going to have low income, moderate income, ethnically and racially diverse opportunities by planning. Now, the Urban Land Institute put out a study a couple of weeks mm-hmm. ago saying, look, you know, you got to shrink this city. They made a mistake. They said you can shrink it by starting to rebuild on just the high ground. Well, you can imagine where the high ground is. It's in the upper income areas, and mm-hmm. It was immediately shot down as inadequate. A countervailing plan is now out, which I think is an enormous cop-out, no matter how well-intentioned it was. It said, well, let's let people settle wherever they want to, and then we'll look over the city in 3 years, and where it's not working out, then we will move people out of the areas that are going to become mm-hmm. Unworkable. I mean, that's a political cop-out. It basically says we're going to move people twice, once from a hurricane, and then we'll kick them out 3 years from now. What do you got to do? The state of New Orleans, of Louisiana, and the national government have got to say, before we pour any money into rebuilding this city, we're going to have a plan, and you better get busy. And it's going to say we will rebuild and subsidize the rebuilding of a footprint which is one half. And that one half better be planned to include a fair cross-section, a fair opportunity for everyone. And at that point, FEMA should be in the business of buying out of those houses and the Congress that are outside the perimeter of the new city.
But here, we're not talking a distant challenge. The rebuilding of New Orleans is being laid out and taking shape right now. I mean, if it doesn't happen this way, presumably it won't happen this way.
Well, and we'll repeat this disaster all over again. And not to make too fine a point of this, but what the Bush administration and FEMA are doing and the Congress now are putting taxpayer money into the rebuilding on a sort of random basis of the entire footprint of the city. It's not that people are just sort of kind of, you know, going back to the old homestead. It's that we have federal congressional money subsidizing yet another disaster in a city that will be totally unworkable.
So the picture together for us. Do we have the kind of political setup in this country, Bruce Babbitt, that's going to respond to public concern about the environment, or does it leave politics in the hands of money, which I guess means developers?
Well, we're in one of those periods of American history now. We're kind of like, you know, the Gilded Age of the 1890s, like the Roaring Twenties, in which, you know, the public interest is not being followed or observed very much, and in which we are a society, including our politics and our daily lives is dominated by this quest for individual wealth in the rules, in the concepts of fairness and equity and economic justice are kind of being cast aside.
Bruce Babbitt, former Secretary of the Interior, former Governor of Arizona, one-time presidential candidate, author of the new book, Cities in the Wilderness, and New Vision of Land Use in America. Mr. Babbitt, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Tom, pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.